Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fill My Eyes and Company with Poetry. Hope everyone's doing well, and I hope you're having a great week, and I hope you have a better weekend to follow. Yes, happy Friday. it's been a long and crazy week. Hey, Rex, how are you tonight?
All righty, what's doing?
Not too much. My son handed me something to read right before the song ended, and I was, like, torn between this and that. But, it's Friday again. God, it seems like we just did this yesterday, didn't we?
Yeah.
Did done to me? Yes, we did. I thought it was soon, like, not that long ago. And I want to say hello to Laurent. Hello, Laurent.
Bonsoir. How are you? Hello, Rex.
If I was better, I'd be this. And we also have Bill Schiller joining us. So hello, Bill, and welcome to the show.
Hi. Good evening, gang.
Hello, Bill.
Hey, Laurent and Timidus.
Hey, good evening.
Good to have everyone here tonight. It's always, always interesting. Fridays are always interesting. So, yes.
You say hello to Robbie and CL.
Oh, hello, Robbie and
hello, CL. On the board.
Hello,
guys.
Yes, the first I've seen them. So, hey, you fellas. Hello. It's good to have you guys here. Hey, Laurent, why are you talking to us and saying, did we say hello? Yeah, they're really talking to you. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Oh, come on now.
Oh, trust me, I'm just joking. No.
Oh,
no.
I know that.
Yes, sir, Bubba. No. So, anyway, anything new and exciting that we need to talk about? Let me think. Nothing I can think of. You know, it's always something. Uh-oh, he's battling the forces of darkness. Good heavens. It makes me nervous. Yeah, it's been just a long and I don't know. All I want to do is sleep. I think I'm ready to hibernate.
Mrs. Rip Van Winkle.
I am, yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Sleep, 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 sleep. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Robbie's been watching shows that maybe I need to check out because, different kind of heading than I'm used to.
Yeah, you need the inspiration, right?
Yeah, right. Sure I do. Anyway, on another note, what's happening to Yale Howard? It's good to have you here. Yeah, so I don't know, but we have about 23 pieces on the board, so I guess I shouldn't dawdle.
Let's see.
Yeah, okay, lots of poetry. Lots and lots and lots. Okay, well, let me go over here and see what's first. Oh, yes. Rex, I think we can have you read first tonight. Well,
oh,
I tried to, but I have one that lines up, so that's pretty good. Here we go. It's called Behind the Smile by Ben Hart.
Behind the Smile by Ben Hart. One. Dreamweaver, dream eater, oblivious. Why haven't you told her? Who says I haven't? Well, she might. Even a poet only knows so many words. Juliet. She'll pray for rain to wash the garden off her arms and return what had rooted to seeds falling for the wind. She'll sing of lifeless memories to undead scars, smiles swallowed and reveries borrowed from anonymous eyes to color in the blind. She'll fall for love, promise mumbles, and lose its inward shadow, keeping alive light's fleeting between begging hands. She'll fly on paper planes into cold indigo sunsets, take half an hour holidays from thought when west falls into north. And she'll dream in death of stories told, sunshine made into lemonade, lavender hillsides burning, winter's won, and gray veils lifting. Fireflies. Look, it's God being funny, made moth of man and let woman be starlight. But martyrs of love, we don't need a fair fight. We'll burn because we can, embers in the half-light. Infected. Euphoria, emptiness mirrored, arms that cannot carry me, a byproduct of agony, and how easily it slips behind the smile we tattooed on our lips. And I am anxious, I'll infect you with every kiss. Where I should impart love, I just taste loneliness. Somewhere over the rainbow. I love you like sunlight imparts the spaces between rainfall, because it simply knows no other way but to dance between veils of iridescence, to be found amid the perishing heavens in the falling arms of the love that existed from nothing. A wish that never reached a star, only to find itself starting to shine in the dark, bringing about the day, the memory of youth in a universe senescent, glad to have been even just a distance, incandescence. I love you because I know you will forget me. And poem.
Mm-hmm. Nice read.
All right, Laurent.
Well, nothing love, nothing worse than love that doesn't get repaired, eh? Any of these stanzas exhibit the same thing that Ben constructs every time he goes out. It's a fluid river of imagery, one following another in perfect chord. Metaphors abound, he'll take two entirely dissimilar items, put them together, make it work, which is really something. But what really nailed me was the last stanza. I love you like sunlight in parts the spaces between rainfall because it simply knows no other way. And then that last line, I love you because I know you will forget me. He knows how to turn a phrase. And he's a stunning writer, and this is a stunning poem.
Excellent. Thank you, Laurent. And Bill, how about you?
Very creative. I'm very appreciative of the way this transitions and how it's broken into these chunks that make it so much easier to digest. And each phase is such a separate, conveying of thoughts. But there's a really clear distinction because one doesn't bleed into the next. And I think I like the Juliet section best because you get such a clear picture of this person. They're gardening, and you get the idea that they're dreamy. I maybe get lost in imagination because it talks about how she'll fly on paper planes. Take a half an hour holidays from thought, which speaks to me of someone lost in imagination. And she'll dream in death, it says. So I really like this second section, which speaks to a Juliet. And then, even the name Juliet speaks, it invokes the idea of a romantic figure like that of Shakespeare. That's romantic, but also tragic. So you get a sense of both of those things. In this writing, and it just conveyed so creatively. I love it.
Thank you, Bill. And Jean, how about you?
I like this piece by Ben. I really do. I like how he started it out. Each one of these vignettes were really well done, but we all know, hopeless romantic than I am, I, of course, went to Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That was a great section. But I have to say, when I got down there and I said, I love you because I know you will forget me, that took me right over to Pablo Neruda, to his poem, If You Forget Me. And so I think that's kind of why I was leaning towards that stanza, because it gave me that feeling of that that familiar piece by Neruda. But a very well done, as always, Ben, and I want to thank you for sharing with us, as you always do. Really appreciate it, and nice job. Very well put together piece.
Nice. Thank you, Jean. This does offer up little tidbits. I mean, you look at that first one, there's a kind of sorrow in that, the dream eater, oblivious. Why haven't you told her? Who says I haven't? Well, she might. Even a poet only knows so many words. There's a quiet notation to some fear, some angst, uneasiness. Do I not? Yet he offers up to finish off his lack of words in the moment, despite the fact that he can fill a page with quite the litany of verse and thought and voice. Yet he doesn't feel adequate in her presence. Then he rolls right into Juliet, that note of who she's who. Represents what he sees. And Bill was right with that note to Juliet. There is a quiet note to tragedy within that. I like the Firefly's angle just for the thought of the hope in there with the idea of the Fireflies represent kind of a starlight earthbound as opposed to what you look up to see in the heavens you actually find in your backyard easily. And the infected, that points to love. And still he's afraid, and I am anxious. I'll infect you with every kiss where I should impart love. I just taste loneliness. So he still hasn't made up his mind in that moment. And Somewhere Over the Rainbow hits on that idea of hope, even though he doesn't hold out much for it because he offers on the back end, I love you because I know you will forget me. That idea of passing on in the time and history, so to speak. So, nicely generated thought there, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Okie dokie. I must go over and grab the next one. And dun, 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 dun. This next one. I'm hearing.
I think it's just your ears.
No. You're so silly. Okay. I think I got it. Okay. This next piece I'm going to read, and it's called What Happens to the Time We No Longer Hold by A.R. Mundo. Okay. Kind of make me think I'm crazy. Yeah, okay. Bill, I'll pick you up after the poem. What Happens to the Time We No Longer Hold by A.R. Mundo. The tide draws my sand from between my toes. I try to keep it back, try to draw it to me. Yet I feel it sifting farther and farther away. My heel digs into the sands as the water tunnels, chipping my weight down, down into a mire. Yet the sands are still leaving me, and the water never stops. I wonder where it rushes to in such a hurry, where it will go now that it's free of me. Will my grains end up on another's shores? Will they one day stand at the water's edge, feeling those same grains slip from them? Or will they never again belong to another? Will they now slip through those oceans and dance with the joy of new life unburdened, unfettered by body, by skin, by routine, by life? Free now to be animate within the inanimate, to exist without the burden of existence. Or are those grains cashed in, spent, crushed into fine powder, mixed with ocean water, dipped into over and over until it is depleted, scrawled out as ink upon the pages of my life? What happens to the time we no longer hold? End poem.
Great read, Gene. Thank you very much. And Bill, why don't we start with you, please?
Oh, wait. Got to hit that button.
About a moment ago, my granddaughter hasn't been in here for a few weeks, and now she's very interested to know what I'm doing, and she's poking around, and I was trying to shoo her away, and she would have none of that. So that was that little background noise. But A.R. Mundell's poem here, you know, my first thought is how powerful a tool asking a question is. It's an immediate form of grabbing someone's attention. So even by the title, What Happens to the Time We No Longer Hold, it immediately grabs you and forces you to think what that means and what the answer may be. So it really pulled me in right from the very beginning. And I like the try to explain time in things that are physical, like a tide or in grains of sand, you know, because time is this ambiguous kind of mortal construct, but that Mundell has immediately attached it to something that we can touch and identify is really cool, because it forces us also to think of the motion of those things in terms of time. The tide is a powerful expression, as is sand. And the idea of wondering where it goes, and it says where it rushes to in such a hurry, which again speaks to someone who is aware of of its fleeting nature. And I guess the older we get, we all become more cognizant of that. I know I sure do. And where will it go now that it is free of me? He asks here. I know where it's going. It's going to a lot of these punk kids who are a lot younger than me and feel entitled. They're getting all of my time. Little bastards. Not my grandchildren, though. They can't get enough time. I love poems about time, though I have a love-hate relationship with time in itself. Like before your program started, I was having an awful time. I'm having a much better time now. I guess the thing about time is how good or bad it is just depends on how we're spending it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, much.
Thank you, Bill. Laurent, how about you?
I'll try to be brief. I know that we've got a lot of poetry tonight. Like Bill, I enjoyed the metaphor. It's not an unusual one, you know, grains of sand, time passing, and all that. But it's the way they were used. For instance, or will they never again belong to another? Will they now slip through these oceans and dance with the joy of new life unburdened, unfettered by body, by skin, by routine, by life? It's almost as if she's talking about time that will belong to her that she can't hold, and will that time belong to another? It invites a relationship being established, somebody sharing that time. The last stanza, or are these grains cashed in, spent, crushed into fine powder, mixed with ocean water, dipped into over and over until it was depleted, scrolled out as ink upon the pages of my life? Those grains are gone. Time is gone. Time can be a murderous weapon. It can also be a real loss, right? When you can't hold on and you desperately want to. I thought this was a brilliant little work, very sophisticated, very clever.
Thank you, Laurent. And Jean, you got to read it. What about you?
I did, and I was glad I did. You know, I thought it was an excellent write by Amy. I really loved these lines. I thought they were great. I'm going to read them in a second. I haven't really lost my marbles. Great questions posed in the piece. And just a really, really nice piece of work. But this is, I wonder where it rushes to in such a hurry, where it will go now that it's free of me. Will my grains end up in another shores? Will they one day stand at the water's edge feeling those same grains slip from them? Or will they never again belong to another? Will they now slip through those oceans and dance with joy of new life unburdened, unfettered by body, by skin, by routine, by life, free now to be animate within the inanimate, to exist without the burden of existence? I thought it was just a great expression of thoughts throughout. So well done, Amy, and thank you so much for sharing with us tonight. Nice piece.
Nice. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I get the picture of an hourglass and how it bleeds out, and
yeah.
You see life drawing down, and that's the question that rolls in here. Will my grains end up on another shores? Will they one day stand at the water's edge feeling those same grains slip from them? The question, will they feel the same as I do in this moment, life slipping away, time, the minutiae just edging off, the unfettered by body, by skin, by routine, by life, hits on that idea of what happens once that no longer exists? Is there something past that for us? And then that note to free now to be animate within the inanimate, to exist without the burden of existence. So there's a note to what happens afterwards. Will I be remembered? Is there, or are those grains that were allotted to me were just mine, and now that I've used them up, they're gone forever? And what happens? Because she does hit on that note of dipped into over and over until it was depleted, scrawled out as ink upon the pages of my life. Are these just my sands to be used at this point in time, or do they get traded off somewhere down the line?
Mm-hmm.
So, nicely done, Amy. Thank you very much.
Great thoughts.
All right, Jean. Well, okay. I'll get to you.
Laurent, and the next one for you to read, and this is called We Broaden by C.L. Howard.
All right. We broaden. In the glooming by the fire's light, when the hush of dark befalls us, took lovers' hands where scintillas grow, and passionate grip on barn truss, while nestling sleep in lofty chambers where silken heaven enfolds them, their hearts ensnared by dreamscape's whisper, adventurous play their mind gem, all thought of breath, the sing-song trudging of our hills and dales lies tongue, as we entwine our eternal plane for a forever we broaden. End quote.
Great read, Laurent. Thank you very much. And Jean, we're going to start with you.
Of course you are. yeah, I think this is a great piece by C.L. Howard. I was reading his A.N. when you asked me. As parents, we often become too busy, busy with life, with work, with children, with everything. Sometimes, and by that I mean as often as you can, and even when you can't, you need to look at your wife or your husband and remember them. Remember all the things you love them for. Let your mind and heart fall in love all over again, and let the passions rise and broaden your connection and unadulterated love, which is lovely, you know. So now I have to go back up here and go, yeah. Oof, while nestling sleep in lofty chambers where silken heaven enfolds them, their hearts ensnared by dreamscape's whisper, adventurous play in their mind gem, all thought of breath, the sing-song trudging of our hills and dales lies trodden. I love the way he worded so many of these stanzas. I just really find it to be, what do I want to say? I don't know. I just think each one is special in its own right. And I think that it's just a wonderful, wonderful penning. I do. You know, I loved the way he ended it. You know, then I can just read another stanza. As we entwine our eternal flame to our forever, we broaden. And I just think it was just really well expressed and well done. So thank you so much, CL, for sharing with us. Great piece, and I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jean. Mm-hmm. Bill, how about you?
Yeah, well, the arsonist in me really loves this. And just the whole concept of we broaden. And from the very beginning, it sets the tone with in the gloaming by the fire's light, twixt the lover's hands in the second stanza, where scintillas grow. And I know that scintillas means different things to different people. But when I see that word, I think of it in the context of a spark. And especially in with context of the paragraph, the stanza before it. So the broadening of a fire, and that's what's coming in my mind. And, you know, twixt lovers' hands, there's this spark that grows, and that's the growing of this fire. And the fire broadens from that spark. So I just think it's a really clever way to talk about how people grow and relationships grow. This is such a beautiful metaphor.
Thank you, Bill. And Laurent, you got the reason. How about you?
Well, while nestling sleep in lofty chambers with silken heaven and bowls of, is a lovely description of children sleeping, their hearts ensnared by dreamscape's whisper, adventurous play, their mind gem. It's a wonderful wordplay describing the dreams that they have, all manner of wonderful things fly through kids' heads. All thought of breath, the sing-song trudging of our hills and dales lies from. They've already gone and walked through the hills and dales, the familiar ones. As we entwine our eternal flame to our love forever, we broaden. You, as a family, you grow. You have to broaden. You have to encompass more and more on a daily basis. You have to guide. You have to inspire. You have to exert discipline. All manner of things with children. And the interplay can be tiresome. It can be frustrating. But in the end, it's probably the most satisfying thing that you can possibly do. Great piece.
Excellent, Laurent. I agree with that. I only got one thing to add. I took that first stanza, and I take that as separate from the rest because it offers up something else. It's kind of moral. In the gloaming by the fire's light, when the hush of dark befalls us. You talk about don't wait to the end of life, when to the end of your years, so to speak, on the back end. Enjoy what's in between, because if you wait till the end, then you've waited too long, and then you don't get to that last stanza as we entwine our eternal flame to forever. We broaden that idea of what you just hit on, all those notes. So that first stanza was very important because it's telling you, don't wait till it's too late.
You know, as a nice compliment to the poem, the words from Pink Floyd's song Time echoes in my head. One day you look and you realize 10 years has got behind you. Time can just evaporate so quickly.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. All right, Jean, we're back to you.
All right. Well, where do I go now? I know where I'm supposed to go now. Let me grab this.
You could go a caroling.
I could go. You don't want to hear me sing, though. I keep telling everyone.
You could just keep the beat. Keep the beat with the tambourine.
Oh, Lord. Don't know. Don't give me any instruments. It could be ugly. Anyway. Bill, it seems like CL says you got it. It's a spark. Absolutely. Okay, the next piece that I'm going to read is called Puppet Girl by Teresa Streshenkov and Maeve Edmondson. So, Puppet Girl. Free yourself from the mental demon. Forgive yourself from your painful past. And know that this pain will not last. When you let it all go, the pain goes away fast. Living in a world like Pinocchio, lying every day just to get through. My nose keeps on growing, longer it grew. I just want to be a real girl again. I can't wait to be free and finally breathe and get you out of my memory, forgetting all the complete control I let you obtain over me. End poem.
Great read, Jean, and this was a collaboration with Maeve Edmondson.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you, Teresa. And Laurent, why don't we start with Jean? What'd you think?
Well, when you're involved with someone and you have to use deceit to get by because of the relationship and how it has evolved, I like to use the Pinocchio metaphor or simile. Lying every day just to get through. My nose keeps on growing longer and grew. I just want to be a real girl again. It's almost a play on the theme of Pinocchio wanting to be a real boy. She wants to be a real girl again. When you live a life as a lie, it is a little bit like being constricted. And you don't feel free, and it is difficult to breathe. But once it's all gone, then you forget that complete control, and you're a real girl. It's a brilliant little one, right?
Thank you, Laurent. And Bill, how about you?
I'm still reeling a little bit from Laurent's quoting of Pink Floyd earlier, but it makes me appreciate you even more, Laurent. And I've just been getting familiar with Teresa's poetry lately, and Laurent hit on something important when, you know, the second stanza's reference to Pinocchio. And indeed, Pinocchio wanted to be a real person. But the other thing that comes through in Pinocchio is he didn't want to be controlled. He wanted to break free of the strings that manipulated his life. And that's what I'm reading in this poem by Teresa. And it begins with, I think, a kind of self-affirmation and advice like someone would give to themselves. Free yourself from this mental demon and forgive yourself from the past. Whatever it was, You got to let it go, and you got to move forward, and you know, and not be this thing that was controlled by that other stuff. So for me, it's good advice, but it's not being directed at us. I feel like it's something the writer is trying to reaffirm in their own mind, and it's beautiful, Teresa.
All right. Thank you, Bill. And Gene, you got to read it.
Well, you know, I think the ladies did a nice job with this collaboration. It's a good brevity. I thought it was well expressed. You know, that desire to escape a relationship, a controlling relationship, you know, yeah, it's just an ugly place to be. There's nothing worse than that. And, you know, the last line, I think, really ties the whole thing up. I can't wait to be free and finally breathe. And could you get you out of my memory, forgetting all the complete control I let you obtain over me. You know, so thanks for sharing tonight, girls, and nice job.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jean. Laurent, I agree with you. That line there, I just want to be a real girl again, is very important. Kind of offers up that note of innocence lost within this prism that she was in. And Bill, I agree with you too about the cutting of strings, because she hits on that with forgetting all the complete control, the idea of being a puppet in the moment. But she isn't just blaming him, so to speak, for all her free yourself from that mental prison. She also drops in that note at the very end. She's partly to blame. I let you obtain over me. So there's a double note to the affirmation of not just becoming the real girl again, wanting to go back a little bit in time, but also the fact that she was part of the problem to begin with, not standing on her own 2 feet, and now she has gained that apparent note to her life. So, well done, Teresa.
All right,
Dean, we're back on you.
Okay, and I almost skipped you, Rex. I don't know what I was thinking, but I have this poem here for you. It's called Eld of the Saxons by Poetic Picasso.
Okie dokie. Eld of the Saxons by Poetic Picasso. The tidings of a brash wrath of the king had taught the thoughts of the Norsemen, as 40 years had went and poured thee into a mist, sith the wanton madness before we was felt. A brass dread became an anwood thread, which frightened the barns, and was frightened the barons and women, where within a darkled abode of the dead, the wretched thirst had no longer dwelt. Forth and under a strength of King Athalt, the kingdoms of the kinsmen were wielded, with a loathsome overmood and ranks, were doing weaker and sakes on the grim night. He sent from the Stour hetwares and ents, as the folk in Offos to fear yielded, and the lither banes and bashed and shent, without agon bite and wrecked with might. Midst the rough behest of the woe heathen, his grip upon the Saxons made them fret, and from beyond the mere's wind withinwards came a stiff moon rink from the quarters. From the barn of the kith rose up a voice to durst the warn of a bane swiftly met, as a young Saxon weaned and fed, stir freemen to become his followers. He had rucks of fens for the inkling, as he began to drip forthwith in sights, and word of his sigils over his unwinds spread to the lead and a frunched king, shamed and weary of the losses he sent, his triggest aura beyond the leery heights. Whereupon the knoll of that smoke morning, they horsed them as the men began to sing. Agmund, a camp came to free the corpse from the bloody grasp of the king Athelt, and the lone men Eldon from the tall Fergrim stood left as a stronghold of his kingdom. Shortly the unearth began, and the long knolls strew with the dead as it became colder, when Agmund stood before the heathen, who bore a fiery brawn and least wisdom. His name was Alfar, and a Greek of an old ent. Within the fat Ethel found in the nether fold, as he stared down upon his smaller foe, glaring into his eyes with a willful tease. The bane Saxon durst into a grill gut, had become bolder as the fight strove, when the thirst chuckled and warned the foolish Saxon's heart he was to leave. The The rink did not cower amidst his mane when he durst the thirst amain to fight. Laughing at the ends and swinging his sword, grabbing his torch hilt to fight the heathen. Beyond Ent was not scented any more, for his horse was felt there upon the light. Yarking his old axe to throw the stripling, as he had come to do, till his brethren. He came towards him with a loud roar, whilst he faced to kill the worthy Saxon, as the smelt Saxon smote a toe of the Ent, stagging him afterwards in heter wax. An unwieldy thirst withered and fell gross unto a ground as a yell began to wax him, and his ire here asserted to the mist, at the body of the Ent lain in twin hates. Dead was a swear, thirst he livered, the thoughts and his friends was before, and with fettle and the bellows he heard, as the men lifted up quickly their swords. They drank upon the sundry horns of mead, overtaking the grupal kingdom of Alfard. They quelled whence the newest king rose, to the weekly gift stood, soon foretold in words. With the souls of the slain then reaped by an apple ware within the oath of kinsmen, whereupon Agmund had become the king, sought in the Saxons, Jutes, and Frisians. For 60 years he came to Rixel in Eddiness, and the Aldalifest lands on the rank of horse Norseman, while his name lived in the lore of elders, and begotten was the eld of the Saxon. End poem. Sorry about that, Frank. Bill, why don't we start with you, please? Damn.
So, my favorite type of poetry has elements of characterization, setting, and conflict. I know it's not a requirement, but I look for those things in a great poem, and poetic Picasso delivers on all those fronts. And when I think of the genius in this writing, I think first of the kind of an academic requirement, because the language that he's using is of another era, and if you didn't know it, you'd get a little bit lost in it. He provides a glossary at the end, but even as you're reading it, it kind of is a little reminiscent of Lewis Carroll for me. I didn't know what Forby, the third line, it says, as 40 years had went Forby into a mist. I have never heard of this word Forby before. Just like Lewis Carroll uses odd language. But even though I don't know that word, I can get a sense of what it means just from the way he's used it. And the language is so impressive because you would have to have some sense of that language. It's not the kind of thing that an ordinary mind can immediately think of without harking back to a language of another era. So I'm really impressed by poetic Picasso's ability to recall all that. And it's really neat.
I just found, thank you, Bill. I just found that. Went Forby is equals the past. And Laurent, how about you?
This is really a pretty remarkable piece. And look, you did a great job in reading this. It's not easy. You did one of his, what was that, a week ago? And it was even harder to read than this.
Yes.
You acquitted yourself quite well on that. You know, it's almost impossible not to draw parallels between Tolkien's writings and this, because they both draw from the same mythologies, the same tales, the same stories, the same histories. And what you do with the information that you've got, of course, dictates who you are as a writer. I mean, this is hugely impressive. If I just plucked any one of these stanzas, ashamed and weary of the losses he sent, his trigger still rode beyond the leery heights, where upon the knoll that smote morning, they housed them as the men began to sing. This is an old-fashioned tale of war, epic heroism, all kinds of things that fired the imagination. He has really done a wonderful job with this. Wonderful job.
Thank you, Laurent. And Jean?
you know, I think that this is another great story told by Frank. And it was a great read, Rex, by the way. I know it wasn't easy to get through because parts of it were a little bit, you kind of have to stop and think, what does this say? Wait a minute. So, it's not familiar words, you know. But I thought you did fine. And but I think in the first few stanzas, he really set a stage for the rest of the story. And he built a wonderful piece from there. You know, of course, I picked up the first two stanzas because that's where he began to kind of bring you into it, into this story. The tidings of a brash wrath of the king who brought the thorns of the Northmen. And 40 years it went forby into a mist. Set the wanton madness before he was felt. And then, you know, I don't know. I just thought he built from there. And, you know, it was a really good piece. And it had that kind of old world feel to it. And that's what the intent was. And I thought he did a fine job. So, great job, Frank.
Thank you, everyone. It kind of reminds me of dipping into back in time, the thought of Grendel and Beowulf. The sort of a saga, an epic tale that you map out and you tell all the whole story in a note that gets passed down from generation to generation by word of mouth, and that's how they used to do these things way back in the day. So this works on that level very much the same way. So much appreciated, Frank. And damn, I should have looked at this earlier.
That's awesome, isn't it? Okay. Well, the next piece I'm going to put up is by Stelina, and this is called Wachasa Walkin. And this is actually a collaboration between Stelina and Gray Eyes Smith. So let me, here it is.
He stands in the majesty of twilight's burnished hour, arms outstretched to the vast prairie skies, as the golden eye of Gisus drowsily turns to slumber, whilst his beloved Tibiki Gisus rises in unparalleled beauty, donned in her pale, luminescent gown, with indigo blue mantle adorned with diamonds. Beholden to the grace that is his creation, he calls the stars together before him, twinkling in their merriment. Kichi Manidu, great spirit, smiles. Breathing deeply, he lets out a sigh, and the winds blow across Lake Superior. Clothed in humility and gratitude, Wachasawika chants a healing prayer in low rhythmic reverence to the Great Spirit, floating on the four winds in the still of night, echoing in haunting refrain, Kitaditsi. Shabwe, they sing, in beauty to Mother Earth. In all her beauty she is resplendent. From high above, they express their love. Centuries have grown under her wing. Tears fall like rain as the humble ask for acceptance under a bruised sky. Seeking forgiveness, They ask the Great Spirit for peace as the goose flies north. Chi Miigwecho, Great One. From your omnipotent power, you graciously endow Wichazawakan with the gift of healing as you whisper to Mother Earth on the wind to offer her plentiful bounties, easing pain, weaving wounds, and cooling fevers. Kichimanidu, Great One, all bow before you.
Wow.
Great read, Selena. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It's much appreciated. All right, Jean.
This is a fabulous piece between Gray Eyes and Selena. You know, it definitely reads as a prayer. And it's very well done. I love the use of the Ojibwe language throughout. Laurent and I have been down that path before. Of course, I think Laurent picked the longest word in Ojibwe that existed. But this is just beautiful. It really, really was. There was Sabo, they sing in beauty to Mother Earth. In all her beauty, she is resplendent. From high above, they express their love. Centuries have grown under her wing. You know, tears fall like rain as the humble ask for acceptance under the bruised sky. Seeking forgiveness, they ask the Great Spirit for peace as the goose flies north. And I'm not going to pretend like I know how to say that, but it's just really, really well put together piece. I really enjoyed it. Great job, you two.
Thank you, Jean. Bill, how about you?
Just so beautiful. And I was trying to figure out the origin of the language, and I'm not sure if it's Lakota, but that's what I thought it was, Lakota Sioux. And I get the what comes across is what I'm hearing is something like a shaman or holy person leading a ceremony of prayers, and the overall feeling for me is one of reverence, just an incredible respect of the sacred nature of Earth and what it represents to these people, the sky and the Great Spirit, wildlife like the goose, and how they're just almost like a prayer, yeah, but a tribute as much as it is a prayer. That's what, and it's beautiful in that sense for me.
Thank you, Bill. And Laurent, how about you?
Well, many cultures, songs and prayers to great God, a great spirit, to nature itself. And I've always thought that an Indian chant, and by the way, Bill, you're right, the word is reverence. That's what came across very, very strongly to me, the reverence for life in general. And the healing power of their great spirit. The American Indian, to me, has found a tone and a method of thanks and acknowledgement of the great spirit that is more reverential almost than any other culture that I've heard. And I've heard more than a few. It's something in the almost plaintive wailing, the song that touches the heart. You can feel the connectedness of the American Indian to his surroundings, to nature, to all that surrounds him. And this comes through very, very strongly in this particular poem. Clothed in humility and gratitude, Wikasa Wikan chants a healing prayer in low rhythmic reverence to the Great Spirit. floating on the four winds in the still of night, echoing in the haunting refrain, Nita Dizi. It's a marvelous, marvelous piece. And they've managed to integrate their styles together to the point where I don't know who did what. Very, very good piece.
Excellent. Thank you very much. The opening was set the tone for the piece itself and kept that note with the background music going all the way through. And when it got down to that second stanza, that last line, and the wind blow across Lake Superior, it hit me up with the Edmund Fitzgerald when it said the cold winds blow across or the Big Lake Gichigumi. So that brought that back.
That's Hiawatha. Gichigumi is Hiawatha.
No, Gichigumi, the lake itself, it's called the Great Sea. It's part of the it's part of
I know,
the
but in the poem, Hiawatha.
Oh.
Yeah,
I was thinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald song, so that brought that to mind. But that stanza you read was really good too. But the one following hit the same angle. Zabawe, they sing in beauty to Mother Earth. In all her beauty, she is resplendent. From high above, they express their love. Centuries have grown under her wing. So again, keep adding to that note of the treasure and the land, the interconnected notes of people and the land itself. Nicely done, you two. Thank you very much. Well, Christine, we're about on you.
Okay, Doke. Laurent, I'm going to have the next one for you. It's called Root Band Love Grows to Hate by Jenny the Deep. Thanks. Whenever you're ready.
Root Band Love Grows to Hate. Rototilling other gardens, home less and less, sweating under the sun, mess. Harvested we shouldn't have broke me, digging in forbidden gardens, never learning. These roots were made for growing, and that's just what they'll do. After I plow rotted weeds out from under you. You should be planted here, but instead I found you there, sowing what you should be weeping, in our bed should be sleeping. These roots were made for growing. That's just what they'll do. After I plow rotted weeds out from under you. You're the fungus laying in our bed of roses. Your rancid smell disturbs sensitive noses. Unpricked from your thorn, as far as spurting. With dangerous territory, you're flirting. Underground, our once established roots will burn with our love. Till there's nothing left. And poem.
Great read, Laurent. Thank you very much. And Jean, come on down.
You know, I'm trying to think of how to say this. You know, it's kind of like a wow. Like, it makes me want to say yuck, only because of all the fungus and the, you know, like it's definitely not a pleasant thing in my brain. But you know, rototilling other gardens, homeless and less. Sweating under the sun, a passionate mess. Harvested what you shouldn't have broke me. Digging in forbidden gardens, never learning. I'm glad I don't have that garden growing. Not nice. But, yeah, it's definitely, and it's a take on these boots are made for walking. Just so I'm sure somebody caught
these
that.
These boots are made for walking.
These roots were made for growing. And that's just what they do. Yeah, no, it just, it's definitely a great expression of a sour and not so nice relationship. So nice job, Jenny. You know, I mean, you said it well, even though it's, you know, things just don't always be done. You're welcome.
Bill, how about you?
Yeah, it's a very clever metaphor from Jenny here. And to me, it's a cautionary verse and a warning. And it sets it off in this very first stanza, which speaks to infidelity from rototilling other gardens. Like, That seems to me someone who's been missing around with hoes.
No pun intended, okay. Right, Bill?
Yes, pun completely intended.
Absolutely.
And it says that the home is, I mean, if we think of a home and family being a garden, right off in the very first line it says home, less and less. And we get the sense that in this garden where something is trying to grow, there's these other things that are preventing it, which are these weeds that need to be removed. And what I hear her saying is, I'm going to take care of those weeds. And sounds like she's getting ready to pull some pruning shears out. Let's just hope she's not Lorena Bobbitt.
Time to trim their twig and berries. Bye, boys. Quack, quack. And Ron, how about you? What'd you think?
Well, I can give the same conclusion that Bill did, the fidelity at work here. I love the lines, you're the fungus laying in our bed of roses. Your rancid smell disturbs sensitive noses. When pricked for your thorn, it's heart's hurting. Dangerous territory. You are flirting. I really wanted to just belt out these roots are made for growing, you know, like the boots. Can't go there. Maybe Gene will do that for us.
Yep.
But at any rate, this is a great riff on that song and a well-used metaphor for infidelity. I really liked it.
I agree with you. This had a, that nice note where you could actually, I'm reading this, I'm smiling because that chorus was a perfect note to what's going on. These roots were made for growing, and that's just what they'll do. After I plow rotted weeds out from under you, she hit that perfectly. So the great tone with the chorus line in this. Nicely done, Jenny. All right, Jenny, we're about to take you.
Okay. Next, I'm going to bring it to you. And I'm going to give you this piece, The Somnambulist, I don't know, Dirge, by Jyoti Prasmadiya. So here we go, whenever you're ready.
A Somnambulist Dirge by Jyoti Prasmadiya. Again, I had tried to crown, again, I had tried to climb Mount Pagmasus, and again, fate prevented my ascent. Fate, the devil's craft is the compass, who delights in my despair and torment. In their abode, the fiends had convened, and I am sentenced to live without passion, to wander in my sleep, never to be awakened, cursed to sing this dirge with a reckless abandon. Tonight, I will sleep aimlessly, as a dreamer deprived of his dream, and tomorrow I will walk aimlessly, for my guiding star has ceased to gleam. I care no more whether I walk west or east, for I am nothing but a somnambulist. And boom. All right, Laurent, this is different after the last one.
Very much so. In their abode, the fiends that convened, that I am sentenced to live without passion, wander in my sleep, never to be awakened, cursed to sing this dirge with reckless abandon. You know, fate can be very unkind to people. And I like the way he captured that in this. I was looking at his categories, dirge, melancholy, despair, gothic rhyme. This is, what is the form of this? A sonnet? It kind of looks like a sonnet. Maybe if I had one,
yeah.
12 lines. Yeah, he did that well. And you don't get many people writing about a somnambulist. Very, very clever. Very nice.
Thank you, Ron. And Bill, how about you?
Yeah, for me, this speaks to something like writer's block. And I get that from the very first line, where Jody writes of trying to climb Mount Parnassus, and that's such a powerful image from Greek mythology, because Parnassus was the home of where muses live, and therefore, because the muses were there, it's associated with the creating of music and poetry. So what I'm reading in the first line is someone trying to reach the top of this mountain where poetry and art lives, and to find connection with muses who will inspire that poetry, but fate is preventing from reaching that muse, and this torment in that. And it says in the very last line of the first stanza, who delights in my despair and torment. And what is the outcome of being in that, being prevented from having that artistic expression, is answered in the third stanza when he writes, tonight I will sleep dreamlessly as a dreamer deprived. Tomorrow I will walk aimlessly, it says, for the guiding star has ceased to gleam. So it speaks to me of writer's block, not being able to find the words or idea that you want to express, and the torment of that. And the very last line, again, is something powerful. For I am nothing, it says, but a somnambulist, which is someone who is walking around in a sleep or in a stupor or in a dreamlike state, like maybe some of us do when we're trying to find an idea, but it's just eluding our mind. I appreciate everything Jody's writing, and I relate to it as a writer who sometimes struggles.
Thank you, Bill, and bingo, you're spot on. Nice. Gene, how about you? Uh-huh.
You know, I thought that this was just a well-written piece, nicely expressed melancholy throughout. And I grabbed these two stanzas. In their abode, the fiends have convened, and I am sentenced to live without passion. I wander in my sleep, never to be awakened, cursed to sing this dirge with a reckless abandon. Tonight I will sleep dreamlessly, as a dreamer deprived of his dream, and tomorrow I will walk aimlessly, for my guiding star has ceased to gleam. You know, I think that it was well written. You know, if it was a sonnet, because I'm not sure. I think there's like all these little key points to write in a sonnet. You know, if it meets that, he did a great job. If he didn't meet that, it's still a great job. I like what he had to say, and I like the way he expressed it. So excellent job, Jody, and thank you so much for sharing with us. Hope to see more of your work soon.
Excellent. Thank you, Gene. It's not an exact, but it's sonnet style, because he doesn't follow the strict guidelines as far as syllabic counts. But that's okay. You still offered up that note the way it goes. I agree with Bill as far as what this represents. And the last two lines, I care no more whether I walk west or east, for I am nothing but a somnambulist. That thought of having, being in such a melancholy, depressed angle that you no longer have that muse to sing in your ear, you do kind of sleepwalk through through your day, because your mind is trying to pass through that whirlwind that doesn't materialize anymore. And you're irked to the point where you're just gliding in the moment instead of actually doing what you love. So nicely done, Jody. Thank you.
Nice.
All right, Gene, we're back on you.
Okie dokie. The next piece I'm going to put up is called Life is Like a Tangle by Darkened Auras. And I'm going to give this one a read. Okay. Life is Like a Tangle by Darkened Auras. Life is like a tangle within a child's hair. Don't know how to get through them, and where there's one, they're everywhere. Just try to keep on scraping by, like a comb ratting through locks. Sometimes it makes you want to cry and try something unorthodox. Start tearing down the blockades like detangling spray. Starts to dissolve and then soon fades. as it creates the way. Soon you will be driving quick. Time will get you there, like the bristle gliding slick through a child's tangled hair. End poem.
Great read, Gene. Thank you very much. And Bill, why don't you kick us off? What do you think?
Well, when I read anything that's relating to children, it automatically makes me think of things I had to deal with as a parent and now as a grandfather. And when we try to get the kids ready to go somewhere and how you just struggle. I mean, it's enough to try and get them in certain clothes, but then when their hair is all tangled, it's a real chore to try and get through it. So I respect what's being said here about how sometimes life is the same way. It's just hard to get through it, and it's just a big metaphor for dealing with life. And maybe sometimes we do need some detangling spray, whatever that is. Jelly beans work good for me. You just have to work it is the implication here at the last stanza. And soon you'll be driving quick. Time will get you there. But it takes work, and you just have to keep working at it. Very, very cool poem.
Thank you, Bill. And Laurent, how about you?
Yeah, this is very clever. Like, this is like a tangle within a child's hair. Don't know how to get through them, and where there's one, they're everywhere. You know, you glide smoothly through a day. You hit a roadblock, overcome the roadblock, continue on, there's another one, and every day has those roadblocks. Life has a roadblock or a tangle. The metaphor used, start tearing down the blockades like detangling spray. Starts to dissolve, and in three phases, it creates a way. Once you begin to tear the blockades down, it's almost as if you've learned to live life. You've learned to take a sideways step, let danger pass you by, avoid the pitfalls and the pratfalls, and soon you'll be driving quick. Time will get you there, like a bristle gliding slick with a child's tangled hair. Very clever, very well done.
Nice. Thank you, Laurent. And Jean, how about you?
You know, I thought this was excellent. I could totally relate to the whole thought, you know. I always had tangled hair. My hair was long, and it was a pain in the neck to get through. And, you know, sometimes life can just be the same way. You know, you have to figure out different ways around things and how to get through it. And, you know, I really like this. I think she nailed the whole thought process in this. You know, where am I going here? Life is like a tangle within a child's hair. Don't know how to get through them. And where there's one, they're everywhere. Just try to keep on scraping by like a comb ratting through locks. Sometimes it makes you want to cry and try something unorthodox. You know, it does. It just makes you want to, no matter what the struggle is in life, it is. It's just like that tangle. You have to figure out, can you undo it? Can you cut through it? What's the answer this time? And I think that this was just really great. So excellent job, Dark and Doris. Wonderful metaphor in this, you know. I really appreciate the way you pulled this together. Mm-hmm.
You're right, Jean. Christina tackled the tangle with a great analogy, and she even dropped the note in her AN. I know this all too well. I've had a sensitive scalp and very tangled hair my whole life. So she draws from herself to on the analogy and plays out the angle quite well. So well done, Christina. All right, Gene, we're back on you.
Every time you say that, we're back on you, I get this really uncomfortable visual.
But that goes back to the Bugs Bunny reference. Dog pile on the
rabbit.
Dog pile on the
rabbit.
Hey,
okay,
I'm going to the firewood tonight, though. Ha ha ha.
Okie doke. Now, the next piece I'm going to put up is by Robert M. And it's called Out of My Element. So I put the link up. The link is not the it's not going to take you where you think it normally does. Anyway, here we go.
This is my recital of Out of My Element. Time, it seems, is a solemn teacher, if one would care to listen. Yet naivety blinds this lowly creature with eyes that want and glisten. Staring into the fires of naught with gaze on a tempestuous ember, the feeble mind had already forgot what the heart may never remember. Cinders of sorrow rest within the caged contemptuous core, incinerating my every sin until the fires burn no more. Failure birthed in human form, such promise lain to waste. Wells of vigor now rancid and warm erode with diabolical haste. Pummeling rain coalescing pools in the brutal cycle of decay. Frigid despair tyrannically rules, washing notions of warmth away. Mental wastelands now submerged beneath the flood of nihility. Channels of mediocrity then converge, drowning out my so-called ability. Reluctantly, the waters receded after nourishing seeds of doubt. Years of rain will be succeeded by years of torturous drought. Remaining life withers into dust, meaningless grains of defeat. Hope, denial, delusions of trust, all victims of the sweltering heat. As I return to the waiting earth, with my ashen heart in grasp, my relevance in all its dearth dies with my final gasp. A mind that lost all of its wonder, a heart that lost all of its flame, a storm that lost all of its thunder, merely the remnants of a poet in name.
Great read, Robert. Thank you for the SoundCloud. Much appreciated. And Laurent, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just a little distracted looking at this page. Dean, is this your construction?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And all the archives, so the radio archives from 2016 to the day?
Well, there's not very – there was a big hiatus on this because it became too much for me to juggle. So there was a big gap there, but there is a lot there. This is all the poet of the month and, you know, the things that I have posted throughout the last, well, I think the last
very
thing I
cool.
April of 2019, but, you know, yeah. Uh-huh. So it's, yes, yes.
Well, just okay, the, well, actually, that had nothing to do with the poem, but I when I read Robert's poetry, I wonder at the pain, or certainly the awkward perspective that he may hold of life, and his melancholy, his sorrow, his sadness reaches depths that I wonder sometimes how you survive it. A mind that lost all of its wonder, heart that lost all of its flame, storm that lost all of its thunder, merely the remnants of a poet. And named. Here we have someone who time is not dealt with well. Cinders of sorrow rest within a caged, contemptuous core, incinerating by every sin until the fires burn no more. Somehow he has sinned in a way that, in order to expiate that sin, he burns and burns until sins are gone. Then. Only then will he stop burning. But who knows when that would be. It seems to go on from poem to poem. But each one has the melancholy tone, and they are entirely different and really well written. So it's not like this one Victorian kind of thing. He explores the depths of his misery intelligently, creatively, and in some ways, all too relatively. Well done, Robert.
Thank you, Ron. And Bill, how about you?
My first thought, and I'll try to make this fast, and because it touches on something I've harped on so often, and you have to excuse my expressing of an opinion. I think the greatest poets, their greatness didn't come from writing poetry, because poetry isn't just the writing of poetry. Being a poet involves feeling, how you think, how you feel. And what I'm hearing in this poem is someone wrestling with the fact that some of that has left them over time. In the last stanza, it says, a mind that has lost all of its wonder, a heart that lost all of its flame, and merely the remnants of a poet in name. I mean, there are people who call themselves a poet because of what they write, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're poets if you think about in terms of the feeling and the mental aspects of that. And it's in that feeling and thinking that enables great sculptors to be considered a poet, or artists like Da Vinci. He was a poet. I mean, because poetry involves so much more than writing lines. And this guy is out of his element because he's not feeling the things he used to feel and thinking the things he used to think. That's what I'm getting in this poem, and it's very sad.
Nice. Thank you, Bill. And Jean, what about you?
You know, as so many pieces of Robert's are, this is very painful. I can feel the pain in it. You know, whether it's a loss of feeling like he's lost his ability, feeling like he's lost his grip, whichever way you want to look at that. I think he expresses the sadness and the pain very well. I like the last, well, I didn't like them, but out of them, I picked these last three stanzas. Remaining life withers into dust, meaningless grains of defeat. Hope, denial, delusions of trust, all victims of the sweltering heat. As I return to the waiting earth with my ashen heart in grasp, my relevance in all its dirt dies with my final gasp. A mind that lost all of its wonder, a heart that lost all of its flame, a storm that lost all of its thunder, merely the remnants of a poet in name. Those three there are just, I don't know, it's a big ouch in my brain. So the poem is fabulous. It's very well written, and he always gets his point across very well. It's just sad. It's a great job.
Nice. Absolutely. I hit on that. Hits on the yet naivete blinds this lowly creature, and the feeble mind had already forgot what the heart may never remember. Incinerating my every sin until the fires burn no more. Failure, birth in human form, such promise lain to waste. Wells of vigor now rancid and warm, erode with diabolical haste. There's pain and anguish in those lines. And on the back end, of the hits on that idea of, as I return to the waiting earth with my ashen heart in grasp, my relevance in all its dirt dies at my final gasp. A mind that lost all of its wonder, a heart that lost all its flame, a storm that lost all its thunder, merely the remnants of a poet's name. The idea it hits on, because heart walks through this, so something in the heart has been dislodged to the point where the mind cannot keep it together. So there's a very good note in this to Poe. The darkness,
yes.
The desperation, the voice itself. So, nicely done there, Robert.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. The next piece I'm going to put up, Laurent, this is your piece, Joy in Mid-Flight. By Laurent Yvonne.
All right. Let me get there. There we go. Joy in Mid-Flight. Time's passage, bird wings flight of romance, flutters and flaps free, ignoring gravity, drawn to the apex of a July sky, spendthrift in emotion, profligate in exaltation, whirling, whirling, freedom's essence, darting dervish of the alien instinct. Joy is the hour of its own discontent, bandied like laminar demanding the rent, sweet soul of feathers and breath, rare the dark hawk with black claws of death, piercing eyes, beak surgically sharp, blister neck, he's ripped you apart. Torn feather, forlorn, drifts to the ground, lays among the weeds, light spent, discharged, hollow arrow of elation fallen from its quiver, essays a lift with friendly breeze, and fails. Pity, that morning's playful wind, abandoning a toy you'd have sent soaring aloft. Atop a distant fir tree, a nest at its crown, wobble twin siblings over small bones and down. Jubilation, the fuel enduring its ingestion, transcendental transference, never ends. Mother had flown, reaching for her sky, to snatch joy in mid-flight, past her by. End quote.
Great read at all. Thank you very much. And Gene, let's kick with you, Foyt.
Well, you know, I thought this was a really well-penned piece. It was nicely expressed. And I thought you did a great job putting survival in perspective. You know, one bird's out there just swirling and flying. And, you know, I mean, I get the visual on that so well. And here comes this hawk. Yes, hawk, right? I think it said hawk. If not, it didn't. But it was. But that's okay. That's what I got. And, you know, comes and just snatches it. Because survival is, you know, they have to feed the young in the nest. So, you know, something as simple and as playful and as free-spirited as the very beginning of this started out, took a turn, got kind of ugly. But there was a purpose. It wasn't just because. You know what I mean? It just wasn't a wasted...
That's nature.
Absolutely. That's nature. So I think you did a fine job with that. Reminded me in thought
Thank
of
you.
Another piece you had written. So, yes. Absolutely. Good job. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Gene. And Bill, how about you?
Well, my first thought is how Laurent always imparts such a... wisdom and complexity into the things he writes, and I like the idea of this comparing love and joy to a bird in flight and how it flaps along and soars, and this free, peaceful, serene way, even as there's forces like gravity trying to pull it down, or enemies like the hawk in this case that would snatch it. I'm a little confused by the final line because I can take it as two different ways, like that moment when you are stopping in the middle of something and you realize what I'm doing is incredible and fun, and you just grab hold of the realization of how wonderful that moment is. So when I hear to snatch joy in mid-flight as it passes by, for me that could mean that, but I also see how it could mean this dark force of like the hawk swooping in to grab something that is so happy and free and destroying it. It's kind of like when you're having a great day fishing. You know, the fish are just swimming along, minding their own business, having a good time, and then you snag it and pull it in, destroying all of their joy. And I kind of sense some of that with the idea of this bird and the hawk. Great, right, Laurent?
That's very perceptive of you. I actually thought that as it passed her by, it was not a well-constructed line. But then I looked at it carefully, because if the bird is joy, and he's just flying for the sheer joy of flying, jubilation as a thing, fuel, right? Enduring, it's ingestion, it lives, it continues, which is where you have transcendental transference. Now, mother of the babies, right? She has to feed her babies. You know, if the bird she's going to catch represents joy, okay, fine, it's a noun. She snatches it out of the air in mid-flight. But it's also perhaps her joy, you know, and everything you said was correct as well, Bill. It's a nice dissection.
Nicely said, Bill. All right. I guess I got to be dipping then, huh?
You always are, goddammit.
Well, the way you formed this and read it, because you offer up that note right at the beginning, the joy in mid-flight. So, I mean, the ease would be to roll on with the nature order of this, but as an analogy, you can walk that as mid-flight to mid-life, and that joy that you offer up in the last line, this match joy in mid-flight as it passed her by, was that note that she had enough of what was going on, and it was her time to leave that nest at home with hubby, because I'm taking that second stanza with the hawk, being that guy that comes out of nowhere to snatch the woman, so to speak, and the husband is the one shredded in the moment. And you hit that note of, torn feather, forlorn, drifts to the ground. It lays among reeds, delight spent, discharged. The joy gone there in the moment of what once was a happy nest. And then at back end, atop of a distant fir tree, in the nest of its crown, squabble twin siblings over small bones and down. The idea of leaving them to their own devices with the trauma. Jubilation of fuel enduring its ingestion, transcendental transference, never a question. The idea of she found something newer in the moment, something that really piqued her heart, the joy within her. And that's why that last line rings in mid-flight, kind of a midlife crisis moment where she takes advantage of what's offered and decides to abandon everything that's been come before.
I like it.
All right, won't go that way. Back to you, Gene.
Better.
Okay, here we go. This next piece I'm going to put up is called Human Being by Casey Day. I have an audio for this. So,
oh, cool.
Here we go.
Human being. I used to think I could only see the pretty side of life when I'd see double. Used to think that if I kept at it, I'd stay out of trouble. Used to think I had a choice when it came to happy endings. Used to think that hands that broke were also capable of mending. Now I see that maybe I've been blind. Now I know there isn't always a reason in life. Sometimes we're meant to fall, and sometimes we're meant to fly. Some were meant to live, and others born to die. And so I cry. Every teardrop I have left, knowing that nobody will ever see the tears I've wept or know what it was like living on the edge inside of being. That's the hardest truth. It's that I'm a lie you believe in. That's what it's like, human being.
Great read, Casey. Thank you for the sound pad. It is very much appreciated. And Laurent, let's start with you.
To be thought of being a lie that is believed in really gives me pause. It's kind of a profound thought. And that's what it's like, human being. I think essentially she's saying that's what it's like being a human. The ability to see, you could argue against the point of view on this, but it's a personal point of view, so how can you argue that? If that's the way you see things, you see things. But I really do believe that people give themselves purpose and give themselves a reason for life. Now, if you can't do that, all right, you can't do that. But I think that's, if you don't give yourself meaning, if you don't at least attempt to fly, to live, to engage, instead of just being born to die. And so I cry, and that's the saddest part of this whole thing. She realizes all of that, top to bottom. And she knows that the tears that she has cried are going to be tears that nobody's ever going to see or know what it was like living on the edge instead of being. And Casey wrote a beautiful piece here, very profound.
All right. Thank you, Lamont. And Bill, how about you?
Casey, this is really deep. And it feels self-deprecating in a sense for me. But overall for me, the theme is someone trying to recognize or having trouble with their awareness of who they are and the way that they're perceived by someone else, because there's some kind of conflict in the way they see themselves versus the way this other person sees them, which may be in a grander or better sense, I'm thinking. And as much as it refers to a human being, I'm a little troubled by the fact that it uses so much of human doing to describe human being. And in human doing, I mean being, the crying, the teardrops, living. It says here in the next to last stanza, living on the edge inside of being, as if it's this one who's somehow acknowledging I'm something less than a being. I'm living on the edge of that. And the hardest truth, it says in the last stanza, is that I'm a lie that you believe in. And that truth for this person is knowing that the other person is believing in a lie. And I don't know if that's – I have to remind myself constantly that these things are not biographical, but – inspired contrivances. And I just think it's such a sad thing to think that someone could believe in you, and while you're thinking, oh my God, what you believe in is a lie. That is such a hard emotion to live with. And the profound sadness in that is gripping. Good job, Casey.
All right, so thank you. Jean, how about you?
I love this piece all the way through. Because, I'm always, I'll grab this stanza or that stanza. This one, I can't pull any one of them because I think they all just are so woven together in thought. I love how she started this out. Absolutely. I used to think I could only see the pretty side of life when I'd do double. Used to think that if I kept at it, I'd stay out of trouble. Yeah. Used to think I had a choice when it came to happy endings. Used to think that hands that broke were also capable of mending. I mean, it just goes on. And the ending to this was pretty incredible. The last stanza I liked as well. There was something about that. You know, every teardrop I have left, knowing that nobody will ever see the tears I've wept or know what it was like living on the edge inside of being. There's just not a bad spot in it. And there's nothing that I can say, stands out above the rest, because I think it's all good. So nicely done, Casey. And thank you so much for sharing with us tonight. Exceptional piece.
Excellent. Thank you, Jane. You just read those first two lines. And I think they are very important, right down to the used to think that hands that broke were also capable of mending. There is a certain note on the outlook of what one sees. It hits on the idea of rose-colored glasses. And then that next line, now I can see that maybe I've been blind. Reality kind of walks in, and you get that tear in the makeup of what one thought. And all of a sudden, lost becomes the note that comes out after that. Now I know there isn't always a reason in life. Sometimes we're meant to fall. Sometimes we're meant to fly. Some were meant to live, others born to die. And so I cry. That note of being lost right there, that the world has been separated from what they thought was, but realized is, has kind of set them on an angle, which hits at the idea of what's the point? Why, if this is all happenstance, and this is by chance, and this might be as opposed to what I think should be, then why are we here? That's the kind of idea I'm getting out of this. And then the thought of the living on the edge inside of being, that note right there is actually not just inside of being, but actually the inside of being is the reality, knowing that what I used to believe doesn't hold water anymore. And now I'm forced to live in something that I can't quite comprehend, because all of my ideals, my thoughts, my ideas as to what was no longer exist. They got crushed in the moment. And the back end, that's the hardest truth. It's that I'm a lie you believe in. That's what it's like, human being. The idea that all of a sudden everything that you knew of gets separated and you get born into a new reality of what really is. And that is a hard note to being a human being when everything just kind of is crushed in the moment. So I like that. Thank you, Casey.
Absolutely. Okay. The next piece I'm going to put up is called The Mystic Mermaid by Julie Buck. I'm going to give that one a read. So here we go. The Mystic Mermaid by Julie Buck. I was erected by semen to play homage to the Mystic Mermaid. Note the sharp turquoise waves constructed around me, grasping. I have no spirit lent to luring anyone to die by wicked ocean gaspings. Nor do I create storms simply for chaos and turmoil. In fact, I could very well be a figment of your overtired, overboozed fisherman's eyes imagination. Fisherman's eyes, imagination. Mermaids desire peace for all marine creatures and are playful and independent and live in mystery. Be it no wonder their deep connection to rebirth and fertility, given their home is water, and sailors passing through invite a few to come up for a tease and a smile. And to remind them, should they survive this voyage, at home waits for them a full human female, hungry to ease their worry of their travels, and now eager to see how land life unravels. End poem.
Great read, Gene. Thank you very much. And Bill, why don't we start with you, please?
Well, I noticed at first that this writing was connected to a picture prompt of a mermaid, and how well this you know, correlates with the image that prompted it. And then it goes to describe, you know, the life of a mermaid in a really interesting way, indicating that they're not this threatening thing, because in the third stanza it says, I don't create the storms simply for chaos and turmoil, as if to say, you know, I'm not the one responsible for all these problems. And hey, by the way, it goes on to say, I might not even be real. I could just be a figment of your imagination. And it says, mermaids desire peace for all creatures and are playful and are independent and live in mystery. But I think actually isn't there supposed to be a treacherous quality to mermaids too? And they will lure sailors and drown them. So I don't think mermaids are always have been considered peaceful and fun, but dangerous things to toy with. And but in this verse, we're not getting that. It's relating to this innocent, ethereal quality of these, and it's beautiful in that right, and so appropriate for the image that inspired this. That's all I got to say.
Thank you, Bill. And Laurent, how about you?
Well, this kind of turns the role of the mermaid around a little bit. Some people would say, you know, the mermaids could be siren-like, luring you to a bunch of hard rocks and pain. But the mermaid says, I have no spirit lent luring anyone to die by wicked ocean gaspings. Gaspings would be anything said, anything sung. And she doesn't even necessarily exist. Maybe I'm just a figment of the imagination, kind of stepping outside of the fall and breaking that fourth wall and getting that standard. And she hastens to add mermaids, desire peace for all marine creatures. They are playful, independent, live in mystery. It's a very clever take, absolutely gorgeous image. I enjoyed this particular Twisted Tuesday's poem by Jean, contest by Jean, excuse me, and this poem I'm sure did well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, Jean, you got to read it. How about you?
You know, I think that Julie did a great job. I appreciated the great entry into the contest. It was well penned and a great take on the prompt. I really thought it was a clever work, and I really enjoyed it. I was looking here trying to figure out what part I really wanted to pick up. You know, mermaids desire peace for all marine creatures and are playful and independent and live in mystery. Be it no wonder their deep connection to rebirth and fertility, given their home is water, and sailors passing through invite a few to come up for a tease and a smile. You know, it was just nice stanzas to wrap. And I like those. I thought that was a nice light section to it. So nice work, Julie. Thank you. Absolutely.
Excellent. I mean, Jules is always deliberate in how she puts forth her notes. So I like the barbed double entendre right up front to open the piece. I was erected by semen. And then turning into that second little touch, the two-liner, I have no spirit lent to luring, deliberate lent. I don't give up things, so to speak. There's a quiet note to even though she's offering up, oh, I am the ease, the queen of the seas, the one that takes care of all things. But yet she finishes out on the back end of this. And to remind them, should they survive this voyage, should they, again, that note going right back to the old tales of mermaids and how they lure and how they take the men down to their watery depths, to their doom and death, so to speak. So there's a double tease in this. She's offering up that note to both angles. Yeah, I'm playful, and you think of me one way, but I might not actually be that, because she offered up the back angle to this. where it sits there, at home waits for them, a full human female, hungry to ease their worry of your travels, and now eager to see how land life unravels. Are you as quixotic in nature on land as you are at sea, or are you just a bore? Nicely done, Joel. All right, Jean, we're coming back to you.
Okay, guys, here we go. Since this is the last one for the night, pretty much, I have a piece here by Arcana Amore, and I have an audio for this, so I'm going to go ahead and do this. So here we go. This is called The Haunted Heart by Arcana Amore. And here we go.
Bitter kiss of winter's chill, falling flakes flutter with sardonic smiles. I'm forever planting roses in barren deserts, dancing in the flames of a dying sun. Inhaling the dust of love's faded shadow, I'm addicted to the taste of absent lips. Exploring the ecstasy of an empty embrace, watching wounded sunsets bleed from afar. This ruinous road meanders melancholy, wandering in wastelands of trickling time, clutching at splinters from an ebbing eternity, drowning amid ripples of twirling twilight. Tears upon tainted snow, cloaking ivory dreams with an ebony caress. Poisoned promises assure they'll endure while spiraling towards collapsing horizons. The flicker of night that softly seeps keeps me company in the dwindling hours, painting portraits from melting memories, afloat in the depths of this haunted heart.
Great read, Arcana. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. And Bill, why don't we start with you, please?
Well, it's Arcana's tip. There's this way of such a talent of touching on these
dark aspects of, in this case for me, it's like someone trying to make something from nothing. Sort of reminiscent of Poe's The Raven, where the character keeps posing a question to this bird that can only say nevermore, as if to torture himself, thinking he's going to get a different response. And I'm saying that because you have someone in the first stanza that talks about planting roses in barren deserts. And on one sense, that can mean, you know, the futility of something, because a rose isn't going to grow in the desert. But on the other side, I can also see where it means trying to bring a sense of meaning or possessing something where there's nothing. And in the same last line, same thought of the last line, there's a dying sun, but dancing in the flames, still trying to make something of that that you know is dying and dealing with it by dancing. So is it a glutton for punishment, or is it ever the optimist trying to deal with, you know, the painfulness of something in a positive way, by dancing in the fire or by planting roses in deserts? I'm not sure if it's pathetic or beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful no matter how. I mean, the writing is beautiful. I'm just trying to think of the personality that does these things. Are they gluttons for punishment, or are they optimists trying to make something of where there's nothing? I get more of that in the second stanza, being addicted to the taste of absent lips. You know, most of us would probably want to taste something else. But if you're unable to get what you want, I guess, you know, you just linger in the flavor you're craving, like Pringles. it's sad and haunting and beautiful with this, all of what Arcana's works to leave me in this kind of haunting feeling. And different ways that you could take it. It could be dark and it could be light at the same time.
Thank you, Bill. Laurent, how about you?
You know, to read as slowly and careful as Arcana did throughout is no easy feat. You have, if your pauses aren't precise, they're going to show up. If you read a little faster or a little slower than a previous stanza, it's going to stand out like a sore thumb. You're taking a big chance when you choose to do that, but he brought it off. No errors. Just each word breathing slowly into the next word. I found his timing so precise, and the tone so appropriate, right? Haunted. The idea of a heart haunted by the pain of absence or depression or anxiety or whatever the reason is. But in this case, of course, it's the dust of love's faded shadow, being addicted to the taste of absent lips. I was going to quote the third stanza as being the one I liked the best, but then I read the fourth with its raining black tears upon painted snow, cloaking ivory dreams with an ebony caress, poisoned promises assure the endure, a spiraling towards collapsing horizon. And that's the one. Of course, I can change my mind again in 2 minutes, but no, okay, no.
All right, we're at the back end of things, Gene, so we got you for last comments and closing.
Okay. Well, I thought that this was a great piece by Arcana. You know, I love his use of alliteration in this, as well as, what else did I write here? And imagery. I thought it was just very well done, and I always love his audios. So I thought there were great stanzas throughout, each very well done. And I started with Beneath the Bitter Kiss of Winter's Chill, Falling Flakes Flutter and Sardonic. You know, the first and second stanzas are ones I plucked, but I really could have picked any of them and been just as satisfied with my decision. Wonderful job, Arcana, and thank you so much. There is no show tonight for Part Sinner, Part Saint, and Once Upon a Time is now moved to every other Saturday starting next week. So if everyone, you know, was looking forward to it, I apologize, but Faziana is not feeling well. I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend and a great week next week. And thank you, Rex, for co-hosting with me. Thank you, Laurent, for hanging out with us all night. Bill, thank you the same. Appreciate you being here and sharing with us. It's a great night. Lots of fun, lots of poetry. And I think I have like 6 or 7 poems carried over. 1, 2, 3. I have Bookworm Dave, Daniel Deschino, Ben Hart, Nunar Cardosa, Jack Tomkovic, Selena 4, Savannah 5, and S Sharp. They'll be put on the board for next week to start the show. Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate everything you all do. Take care and have a great night.
Bye, guys.
Night.